wings snapped and fluttered into me like pieces of paper shredded by the wind. Harlan, as a small dark-haired boy, weeping at a funeral beside a cold-faced, beautiful mother. Harlan trying to hug Dieter, who pushed him away and told him to be a man. And then he was smiling at an older man with dark hair and a hawkish nose. The man was in a classroom, surrounded by boys with instruments. The music teacher from Shaletown Boys Academy. I was startled to feel Harlan's love for him. And then I saw Aaron Race, smiling too, offering admiration and gifts. Then his mother kissing Race, and the boys scolding jealousy. Then Harlan was older, creeping along a corridor and entering a boiler room. He was altering settings on the instrument panel, looking over his shoulder with a mixture of bravado, fear and anguish. Then he was in court, his face blank and cold. Aaron Race was smiling at him, and his face grew larger and larger, distorting and swelling. Then the visions that were all that remained of Harlan were swept aside by a dark tide that flowed inexorably towards me, the thing inhabiting him, hungering and vast. Oh, I was afraid, but I knew what to do. I did not try to pull away or close myself to it. I stayed open, and I let the radiance of my love for Da and for Luke and Harrison and Jilly and for Serenity and Mum blaze out at it. Somewhere in the depths of my mind, I seemed to hear the howling of a wolf. Harlan screamed and flung me away from him. There was blank terror in his eyes. He fled into the crowd. I swung back to the stage, and my mind reeled, to find Da was standing there still, looking up into the scaffolding where Serenity stood. The deadly struggle with Harlan had taken only seconds. "What do I care about your love for me?" Serenity demanded of Da. "I will show you what true love is." She smiled at Da, an empty curl of bloodless lips. She brought her two hands together. She was holding something, fumbling minutely. I saw a tiny orange light flare and die. In my mind's eye, I saw Mum's painting, the blank eyes floating in flames. "Oh, God," I whispered. I opened my mouth to scream out to Da, to warn him. But Serenity had lit another match, and as she brought it towards her, she said distantly, "Why don't you sing now, Da? Sing while I burn." There was only one thing I could try to do, and I did it. "Catch her," I screamed, and I saw Da throw down the mic and begin to run towards the scaffolding. Then I turned my will on Serenity and pushed her as hard as I could. The push hurt me more than anything I had ever experienced. I tried to resist the great sledgehammer of darkness that was descending as Serenity fell, but I had nothing left to resist with. I fell like a stone into utter blackness, my last sight, Serenity falling, flaming. 44. I dreamed of flames leaping and crackling all around me. I dreamed of people crying out and of a jealous, yawning emptiness that gloried in the screams and fear and anguish and the terrible smell of burning flesh. Alizon, I heard the urgency, and part of me wanted to respond to it, but beyond the light waited some unimaginable pain that I could not bear to face. Alizon, another voice, and one I knew. I let it draw me up until slowly I became aware of my head and body. I groaned and retched because I was aching all over. I felt as if I had been savagely battered. What had happened? The last thing I remembered was pushing frantically through a crowd because something terrible had been about to happen. Trying to clarify the memory made my whole body hurt. "Blood around her mouth could mean internal bleeding," said the unknown voice calmly. I opened my eyes and saw flames leaping high and exultant in the darkness. Had I simply climbed from one fiery dream into another? "Careful," the other voice said swiftly. I became aware of the salty metallic taste of blood in my mouth. "My father..." "Shh," said the other person authoritatively, and caught the hand I tried to lift to my head. "Where is that orderly with my bag?" I saw now that the speaker wore white. Then quite suddenly, I remembered Sylvia lifting the camera, the moon glaring out of the night sky like a baleful, unforgiving eye. I saw the snarling terror of the sickness when I opened myself to it and felt the terrible sucking drain of energy it had taken to push physically at Serenity. I saw her fall and burst into flame in midair. I tried to sit up in my agitation, but hands held me down gently but firmly. I shuddered. I had tried to save Serenity by pushing her off the scaffolding, with the slim hope that Dar might have got to her in time to break the fall and to put out the flames, but she had been so high, and she had been burning as she fell. I tried to speak, but the paramedic had risen and was speaking to two security men in tow, pointing away into the fitful darkness. I realized, when darkness fluttered its wings around me, that I was not far from drifting back to unconsciousness. I willed it away, but doing so brought the hovering headache down to roost. It sunk its claws so deep into my skull that I moaned and lifted both hands to my head to stop it from bursting apart. "Alizon, Alizon, you have to resist it. We'll find a way to heal you, I swear." It was Harrison, kneeling beside me, his face taut with fear and revulsion, his accent stronger than I'd ever heard it. His words told me that he had seen Harlan holding on to me and thought I was infected. Before I could summon the energy to reassure him, someone gave a shout, and as he turned to see what was happening, I saw a high bit of burning scaffolding give way with a metallic creak, folding slowly sideways. There was a loud twanging sound, and a severed cord flicked up and began snaking dementedly in the midst of fleeing shapes, hissing and shedding sparks. The sudden brightness illuminated Harrison's eyes as he looked down at me. "I love you," I said.
"What did you say?" Harrison asked.
I said, "I'm not infected, Harrison. What happened to Dar and Serenity?"
"You're not... that's..."
He drew a long breath and visibly collected himself.
"Fine. They've been taken to hospital in an ambulance. We can go after them as soon as the paramedic gives you the okay."
I lurched up into a sitting position with a violent effort. I could not bear to think about the numbness in my mind.
I'm weak. Help me up."
He obeyed, and when I was on my feet, he asked,
"What happened? I saw Harlan."
"He tried to infect me," I said. I couldn't talk about the rest yet, because I was beginning to understand what the night had cost me.
"Harrison, what happened when Serenity fell?" "Your da grabbed some tarpaulins and broke her fall, and then he smothered the flames," someone said.
"You didn't see it?"
He shrugged ruefully. "I was being dealt with by your bouncer friend. But once the fire got into the scaffolding and the wiring, he had to let go of me because there was a stampede for the gates. A lot of people were hurt, which is why the place is crawling with paramedics and police."
I swayed against him.
"You're not okay," he said, looking alarmed.
"Don't let me go," I whispered. His arm tightened. Around us, the scene seemed even more chaotic now that I was upright, and the firelight gave it all a nightmarish quality. There was the scaffolding and the stage, consumed in flame, white jets of water from a fire truck parked to one side, the firemen invisible, except for the fluorescent stripes on their hard hats and coats. Some of the caravans behind the stage were also in flames, and I saw the shapes of people silhouetted against the light. There were lots of people around us, too. Some were clearly audience members who had not yet left, but there were also uniformed police, roadies, bouncers, and people in service uniforms. In the distance, I could still see the cluster of white marquees. They looked empty, but what had happened to Aaron Race and all of the wealthy, famous people who had been there?
"Raoul," I cried, remembering.
"It's all right," Harrison said soothingly. But at that moment, the paramedic returned with her bag.
"You're up," she said, with resigned disapproval. "Well, let's have a look at you."
She opened her bag and shone a small, powerful flashlight into my eyes. Then she pressed my head gently and asked some questions before telling me I was lucky that I had a hard skull. Another paramedic came hurrying by
and asked her to come and help him, as there were a couple of kids who looked as if they'd overdosed on something behind the stage. "I think there were a lot more hard drugs than you would usually get at this sort of thing," I told Harrison after they had hurried off. One guess who supplied them or made sure they were available. Harrison steered me gently in the direction of the white marquees. "Come on, let's find your brother."
"Jesse's here."
"How do you think I got here?" Harrison asked. I hadn't even thought about it, I realized. It had seemed so right and natural that he would be here when I needed him.
Harrison explained. "Jesse called Raoul's mobile to tell you that Serenity had disappeared again. It was out of range, so the service routed the call to his home phone. Jilly and I answered, of course, and he told us your sister had gone off in a green van. It was Jesse who figured out that Serenity was headed here. Jilly and me were all for driving right to Shaletown, but Jesse said we had it all wrong. It wasn't the government or the detention center Serenity wanted to hurt. It was your da. He figured she must have a gun or someone give her one."
I thought that too, when I saw her in the scaffolding. But Jesse was right. She never meant to harm Da physically. She was supposed to sacrifice herself in such a way that it would destroy him in front of all those people, and everyone who saw what happened would have been wounded by it.
"Jesus," Harrison muttered.
"What happened when you arrived?" I asked.
He laughed. "Your brother just railroaded the heavies at the gate, saying it was an emergency. Talk about determined. He didn't lose his temper, but he just went on, and he was so smart he sounded like a lawyer pleading a case in court. Maybe that's what they thought he was, because in the end they let us in to see Raoul. As soon as we were in, I sneaked off. I was supposed to warn your father. Jesse and Jilly were going to find Raoul and you. Of course, we had no idea you were over here already."
I saw Harlan, and I was afraid he would recognize me. Then I got trapped in the audience. That's when I saw Sylvia Yarrow.
Harrison gave me a startled look.
"Remember I told you I overheard them talking about a camera last night? Well, I saw her holding one. She was in here between that barrier and the stage. That's what made me think something bad was going to happen to Da. I didn't think of Serenity until I saw her in the scaffolding." I stopped, seeing Raoul and Jilly coming towards us, Jesse with them looking pale and frantic.
"Alison," he said, "thank goodness you're safe."
Then he did a double take, obviously getting close enough to see the blood.
"What the hell happened to you?"
"It's just a blood nose," I assured him. Jesse gave a distracted nod. "Where are Da and Serenity?"
"An ambulance took them away," I said.
"Jesse, did you hear what happened when..."
"Hear it?" Jesse exclaimed. "I saw it. We all did. I was in those fancy marquees, and suddenly it was on the screens all around us. Then the classical music stopped and the sound went up, so you had no choice but to look and listen. Da and Neo Tokyo were on the stage, playing, but we could see Serenity in the scaffolding."
"You could see her before your father stopped singing?" Harrison asked.
"In close-up, thank heavens she fell, and Da could get to her in time to beat out the flames," Jesse said fervently. "You definitely saw Serenity in the scaffolding before McCall stopped singing?" Harrison asked again, in a queer, urgent voice. This time it was Jilly who answered.
"She was just standing there, staring down at Yada. He didn't know she was there until she called his name. Then he looked up and stopped singing. You could see because the camera angle changed, and we were looking at Alizon's Da from over Serenity's shoulder. God, the look on your Da's face when she was talking." She shivered.
Jesse said, "We could see that she was wet, but it wasn't until she lit the flame that we understood she must have doused herself with petrol. God, I still can't believe it."
He shook his head.
"Alison, I have to go home and get Mum and Miranda and Luke. I'll take them straight to the hospital. Maybe you could go there now if Raoul..."
He glanced back at Raoul, who nodded gravely. We were in Raoul's car when Jilly said, "Why do you suppose the fire caught the stage and scaffolding so well? I mean, you'd think it would have been mostly metal."
"I think the scaffolding was doused in petrol," Harrison said. "That's why the bouncers were so fanatical about keeping people back. They must have been given orders to make damn sure no one got past the barrier. No one wanted the audience to get burned, not physically anyway."
"But why would anyone put petrol on the scaffolding?" Jilly asked. to make sure there was no proof that there was a camera rigged to film Serenity burn in herself. There had to have been a mic as well. How else could we have heard her so well? And what about the lights on her? The whole bloody thing was staged for maximum impact. But the police, wouldn't they think of looking for evidence that there was some sort of set-up? Harrison said. After all, it was a stage, and they wouldn't think twice about seeing cameras and mics. Police would blame the petrol on your sister, and that would be that, so long as no one stirred up any questions. If anyone thought to wonder about how they could see or hear Serenity so well, they'd probably dismiss it, thinking the stage mics must have picked up her voice, and that she was illuminated by incidental lighting. Because why on earth would anyone want to film such a thing? That made me think of Sylvia Yarrow. I needed to tell them what I'd figured out about her filming, but first I had to do something else. I have to go back, I said. I'm coming with you, Harrison announced. No, I saw Gary Solomon back there, and I can tell him what you've just said. He'll talk to the police, and that'll make them look for proof while it's still there to be found, and he'll write about it. I looked at them all, Harrison with his cut and bruised cheek, white-faced Jilly, and stern Raoul in his wheelchair, emanating strength and purpose. I realized how much they meant to me, how their strengths had given me strength. I don't want Race to get away with this.
Alison, you do realize that Harlan, Raoul began,
is the son of Dieter Race and her first husband. I figured it out when I saw them together.
He'll be back there, Harrison said. What if he tries again?
He won't, I said. I don't think he will ever do anything much again. I felt a stab of pity for him. I have to go back alone, because we don't want Gary Solomon to know who you are, remember?
She's right, Raoul said.
Solomon might have gone, Harrison protested.
He's a journalist, I said simply, and this is a big story that links to something he's been investigating. Would you leave if you were him?
What if Aaron Race is back there?
It doesn't matter. He can't infect me.
We didn't know that for sure, Harrison said flatly. Besides, a man who would set up a thing like this is capable of anything, and you might have special abilities, but you're still flesh and blood.
Harrison, I have to go back. I ran into the muddle of light and shadow created by fire engines, torches and flames. The wire barrier had been trampled flat at the center, and I stepped over it. There was a lot of smoke drifting from the stage, and I found myself walking back into a shifting darkness. I coughed and gagged and squinted, trying to make out the faces of people in the red-brown light. I had figured a journalist would be at the heart of the chaos, and I was right. I found him by the stage, talking to a burly policeman. I waited until the policeman had turned away to talk to a fireman, then I spoke his name. Gary Solomon turned and stared at me.
Alison, he said, almost uncertainly, I'm sorry about what happened to your sister.
She did what she did, because she's sick, but she would never have got this far on her own, I said, wanting him to understand. Someone convinced her to do what she tried to do tonight, and someone helped her. How else did she get all the way here, in the middle of nowhere, if someone didn't drive her? How come she managed to get up on that scaffolding without anyone seeing with all those security guards? And why were the lights and cameras on her before she spoke, but no one was giving the alarm and trying to get her down? How come we heard her so clearly if she wasn't mic'd?
His gaze narrowed. Are you saying someone wanted a disturbed teenager to kill herself in front of a 3,000-strong audience?
I looked at him levelly.
All right, who?
I let the silence force him to answer his own question.
Aaron Race.
His voice was tinged with incredulity. I doubt he set up all the stage stuff personally, but he has a stepson who goes to our school. He was here tonight.
Why?
He asked, with the same urgent curiosity as when he had asked why a boy would kill his little brother. But the truth was too fantastic and required proofs I did not want to give, could no longer give. So I asked him a question. Why would a wealthy businessman interest himself in artists of all kinds and twist their lives out of shape? Gary Solomon nodded slowly.
I don't know the answer to that, and there's no clear proof that Aaron Race deliberately set out to change people or harm their lives. There's no clear proof of what you're saying about tonight.
You can interview people. Ask them about when the lights went on Serenity. Make it clear in your story that the lights and camera and sound were all set to capture the action.
My editor will refuse to print the story. He'll call it a beat-up. If you want a reputable paper to cover this, you need proof, Gary said.
Then I remembered. I saw a girl filming the stage from that area between the stage and the barrier. I bet she got Serenity climbing up into the scaffolding, and maybe she even got a shot of whoever was helping her.
So what? The journalist said. It's no good if some anonymous person has footage.
She dropped the camera over there. I pointed, wondering if it was possible that it was still there, that it hadn't been trampled or destroyed by water or falling debris. If you could find it and show it to the police, they'd have to find out who gave the orders to have the microphone and camera set up in the first place. I was sure the camera would contain footage that would incriminate Harlan, but I also had a strong, unfounded certainty that it might show Aaron Race, too, because the sickness in him would want to watch, would not be satisfied to see it on a television screen. That would finish the businessman, even if he didn't end up in jail, and then there was all the stuff Daisy had unearthed. I took him to where I had seen Sylvia Yarrow, and he got out his key ring and switched on a tiny flashlight. Then he began searching. I looked too, but it was the journalist who found the camera and held it up with a cry of triumph, miraculously intact. The record button was still glowing like a little red eye, and I prayed it had fallen in such a way that it had captured all that had happened. Gary Solomon trained his flashlight on it and began examining the mechanism. I took the chance to slip away. He had the scent now, and he would run with the story. If we were lucky, it would tear Aaron Race and his reputation to pieces and maybe even put him in jail. And if the camera didn't contain anything that Gary Solomon could use, next week I would send the stuff Daisy had unearthed. Either way, Aaron Race would be so thoroughly discredited that no one would want to be involved with him. Even if he escaped being jailed, his circle of influence would be drastically reduced. I had just about reached the ragged outer rim of the light from the fire when someone stepped out of nowhere to bar my way. Aaron Race. His eyes reflected the flames behind me, and to my horror and revulsion, he was smiling widely, his teeth oddly long and yellow-looking in the queer light. I had never seen a sight more frightening in my whole life, because it was not just the bloated, consuming sickness that he carried looking at me, but a man who had accepted and embraced it.
"Alison White Star," he said.
"What do you want?" I asked, terrified, despite my brave words to Harrison.
"I want nothing," he said.
He gave a soft, whispering laugh that made my skin crawl, and I realized it was true in some ghastly way. Whatever he, it was, wanted to devour all light and life and love and hope, until there was nothing.
"What is it that you want?"
he asked me, and now there was a black, mindless savagery in his eyes. "I want to go and see my father and sister," I whispered.
"And what are you doing here?"
he asked, nodding over his shoulder without taking his eyes from mine,
"talking to that journalist."
My heart gave a great lurch. I glanced away towards the fire to give myself time to think. Then I shrugged. "I saw him when my class visited the newspaper. I was just telling him he should find out how come the security guards didn't stop Serenity from getting up there." I let a petulance tinge my voice, let it come out thin and childish.
"Journalists have their place," Race said after a long pause. "Well, I dare say our journalist friend will do his job."
Again, he gave his weird giggle that made the hair on my neck stand on end. Then he held out his hand. I forced myself to take it, because it was a test. I put my hand into his, with a strange feeling of sorrowful triumph, because he suspected that I was able to perceive the sickness, and that was no longer true. What I had done to save Serenity had killed the extended parts of my senses. Once again, I was just ordinary Alison White Star. Aaron Race released my hand, his face a bland mask.
I understand your father and sister have been taken to Baron's Central Hospital in town. I can arrange for a car.
No, thank you. I came with my brother, I said evenly, resisting the urge to wipe my hand on my clothes. We wanted to surprise Dad, but...
He blinked once, slowly, like a lizard sunning itself on a rock. Then he said, go.
It was a dismissal, a release, a signal of disengagement. I went past him into the deeper darkness beyond the dying fire glow and the blaze of lights that had been rigged up on poles to illuminate the area so that the firemen could aim their hoses. I was walking away from the light, but it seemed to me that I was walking away from some greater and more irrevocable darkness. In the car, on the way to the hospital, I told the others what had happened.
Then he knows what you can do, Jilly asked fearfully, and I saw from her expression that she was thinking of the fire that had destroyed her grandmother's house.
Oh, it was so hard to say it out loud. My voice came out in a whisper.
He felt nothing, because there is nothing. And I told them. There was a long silence after that, with only the sound of rain patting on the windscreen and the tires swishing along on the wet road, the sound of the car heater humming industriously. No whispers. I looked out into the darkness and prayed that I had not lost my extended senses for nothing, prayed that Da and Serenity were all right. The others began to talk about what had happened before Da had sung, and I forced myself to listen, to add what I knew or guessed to their speculations, because it distracted me from the gaping emptiness inside me and from the terrible flatness of a world seen through normal senses.
It's a battle we've won tonight, not the war, Raoul said at length. We may have lost Alizon's powers, but we still have Sari and Davy, and I'm certain there will be others. It's not over.
Harrison had leaned over, and now he asked softly,
Are you all right?
No, I whispered, and he reached out and drew me so easily into his arms. I could not feel his emotions, only his great mute warmth and the strength of his embrace. I buried my face in his woolly grey jumper and wept for what I had lost. 45. At the hospital, the first person I saw was Dr. Reed, who had treated me all those months ago when I had fallen into a coma. To see her was like coming full circle in a weird sort of way. It was so strange and sad not to smell her essence. Alizon, she said, my poor dear girl, I've just been to see your father, but he's sleeping. How is my sister? I asked. They're both up in the Burns ward. I'll take you. She offered with the brisk kindness I remembered and had once been able to smell. Harrison caught my arm as she pressed a lift button, saying he'd go back and find Raoul and Jilly, and they'd wait in the foyer downstairs for me. I nodded. At the fourth floor, a sign told us that we were entering the Burns unit. I was too frightened to ask how Serenity was, but I kept seeing Mum's painting, the blank, dead eye in the burning cavern of her face. Dr. Reed brought me to a desk and talked with the matron who was behind it. Then she pressed my shoulder and said she would come back later if I wanted to talk. A sister behind the counter suggested kindly that I wash my face before going into the ward. She showed me a washroom, and I stared at the white, black, and red-smeared face, feeling tired and heavy and sad. Then a nurse ushered me along a hallway in her squeaky shoes. "This is the ward where your father is, Alizon," she said. "He'll be a little groggy because we've given him some painkillers for his hands." His hands? I saw his fingers on the guitar strings and felt sick.
"He'll be scarred, but okay."
"My sister," I began, dreading the answer.
"She had some surgery, so she's still recovering from the anesthetic. When she fell, two of her ribs broke and punctured her lung."
She caught me as I swayed and brought me to sit down on a hard plastic chair by the door, peering professionally into my eyes.
"Your sister will be all right, love. A punctured lung is serious, but you got here in time, and the bones will heal."
"The burns?"
"Are bad, but they will heal too in time, and she can have plastic surgery. They were both very lucky.
But now why don't you go in and see your father?
I went into the ward. Dimly, I registered that there were other men in other beds. But I had eyes only for Da, who lay in the bed nearest the window, farthest from the door. His hands were fatly bandaged in white and lay either side of his long, lean shape under the white hospital coverlet. His eyes were closed, and he looked so tired that my heart ached, because I loved him so much, and I hadn't been able to stop the awful thing that had happened. Fighting tears, I stumbled to the side of his bed and looked down at his hands. I couldn't bear to look into his face. "Oh, Da," I whispered, half suffocated by grief. "I'm so sorry."
"Sorry about what, my sweet, brave alley cat?" Da asked. "We saved her."
I looked at him in astonishment and found him smiling, his wonderful, kind, radiant smile. I felt a burst of unbearable, uncontainable joy that seemed to split my heart, because that smile told me that the unbearable hadn't happened. The sickness hadn't won. Da hadn't been broken. I did cry then. Such a wild storm of uncontrollable tears that one of the other patients rang for the nurse, who came hurrying in and wanted to give me a sedative. I collected myself and looked at her.
"I'm sorry, I'm fine. You can't imagine how fine I am."
I laughed and burst into tears again.
"She's fine," Da said. "Well, I'm glad everyone's fine. Do you think you could be fine a little more quietly?" the nurse asked with asperity.
Da promised we'd be good, and then he told me to sit on the bed close to him as she marched out.
"Your hands will hurt if you sit on them," Da said earnestly,
and I laughed and sniffed and scrubbed at my cheeks before carefully pulling myself onto the bed.
"Da, I'm so glad you're all right. I was so frightened."
"So was I, my love," Da said, understanding that I had not meant his burns.
Serenity didn't mean what she said up there. What happened with Aya hurt her, and she got more and more sick. Only we didn't see because she kept it locked up inside of herself.
Da was nodding. "I should have got help for her, but I guess I thought, given time, I would find a way to unlock the hurt and help her. My arrogance almost brought us all to disaster. When I heard her voice and looked up and saw her there tonight..."
He stopped for a bleak moment. Then he looked at me.
"If you hadn't called out to me to catch her, I'd have never realized that she meant to jump. I'd have never got there in time to break her fall and put out the flames. I still can't imagine how I could have heard you above all that noise."
I swallowed. "Da, I..."
"Da!"
It was Miranda's voice, and I turned to see her coming towards us, makeup smeared blackly round her eyes from crying. Behind her were Jessie and Mum carrying Luke, the agitated nurse flapping in their wake and trying to say something about the number of visitors. I slid off the bed. "I'll go out for a while." I looked back to see Miranda fling herself on the side of the bed and begin to cry, but when I tried to pass Mum, she caught my hand. I looked up into her eyes and thought of what lay inside her, the darkness that she had been fighting for as long as I had been alive, which she was fighting even now.
"Oh, Mum," I said.
"My darling girl," Mum said.
"You did it. I knew you could. Nothing else matters but that Serenity is fine, and so is your Da." She kissed me and then let me go.
I went out into the hall, wondering how much Mum guessed or understood, but I knew she would not ask about what had happened, never raise the subject. She couldn't, because it would rouse the nightmare seed she carried inside her. Once again, I was shaken with wonder at her courage, and I thought what incredible parents I had, what an incredible family. I asked to see Serenity then. The sister told me again that she was still unconscious, but I asked if I could see her anyway. She was in a small room, alone, surrounded by green and chrome hospital equipment. There were tubes protruding from her nose and mouth, and her chest, and parts of her neck and face were swathed in bandages, along with both arms. Her hair lay in lank, burnt clumps, and there was a singed smell coming from her that made me feel ill. And what would I have smelled if I had still possessed my extended senses? I wondered.
We had saved her life, her body, but what about the invisible parts of her? What about the spirit that had been wounded by our failure to save Aya from heartless bureaucracy and which had been brought so low that she had been ready to kill herself? And most of all, would she be able to recover from what she had almost done to Da, the dreadful, scalding hatred that had taken her to the top of the scaffolding with such a ghastly intent? Could anyone recover from that? If she was like Sari and Mum and had the courage to fight, I thought, given time and lots of love and people who she could talk to, who might be able to bring her to understand how she had been manipulated, maybe. It might even be that what Da had done in catching her and beating out the flames would help her to recover, because it was something to know someone loved you that much. But whatever else happened, when Serenity woke, she would be questioned by the police, and what she said would add to what Gary Solomon would reveal and seal the doom of Aaron Race. I had no idea what would happen to Harlan, but I found I could pity him, because he had been a victim too. Only he had no one to save him, no family to love, and to be loved by. I reached out to touch Serenity on the cheek, feeling a stab of anger at the dreadful game that had been played with her life. She had been nothing more than a poor little pawn to kill the soul of a king. My head ached as I instinctively tried and failed to reach into her. I sighed, leaning to kiss her cheek and thinking that simple human warmth was still a pretty powerful thing. "I love you," I told her softly, and her eyelids fluttered, but she did not wake. "We all do, and you better hurry up and come back home to us." I kissed her again and crept out. Harrison was waiting outside the room, and I went into his arms as easily as if they had been made for me. "How did you know where I was?" I asked, in a voice that was husky from all the tears I had shed and from the yelling I had done a million years ago back in a dark field. It seemed incredible that only a few hours ago I had been sipping mineral water and listening to a harpist play. "I always know where you are," he said softly, and I felt his breath in my hair. "You know, I heard you call my name at the concert. I heard your voice inside my head." I pulled back a little so that I could look up at him. "I think some sort of connection formed between us that day at the library when you..." "Kissed you?" he said. He smiled at me. "Well, it was some kiss." "It was," I said shyly. His smile faded. "I thought I'd forced you to respond and that you were horrified by it." "I was. I mean, I was horrified that you might be horrified." I laughed, and then we were both laughing. Harrison said, "I really did kiss you to stop that guy figuring we were spying on the poetry group. But when you responded, I couldn't help myself." "I know. Hormones," I said tartly. He grinned. "I couldn't just tell you I reacted like that because I'd dreamed of kissing you like that a million times," he said softly, but without embarrassment. I swallowed, licked my lips. "Afterwards, there were many times when I thought you might kiss me again. I wished it." He laughed softly, shaking his head. "I wanted to kiss you every time you looked at me. I thought I was turning into some sort of sex maniac, and I was terrified that you'd pick up what I was feeling because of your extended senses. That's why I was always so careful not to touch you." I felt a stab of sorrow at the loss, and his arms tightened. "Maybe it's like Goethe said, great powers come to those who need them. If it wasn't for them, your sister would have done what she tried to do. She would have destroyed herself and your father, and it would have been a terrible victory for the sickness." "But it's not over." "No. Like Raoul said, it's a battle we won, not the war. But you've done the main thing. You've made us see the sickness and understand a lot about how it works. We've been talking about it downstairs. Eventually, we'll figure out exactly how successful transmission of the sickness happens, and then we can really fight it." "I know how it happens," I said quietly. "I figured it out when I saw Sylvia at the concert with the camera. That day at the shed, Harlan said she had to film something,
and she said she didn't see why she needed to when the organizers would be filming. But he insisted.
I suppose they intended to use the footage to hurt even more people, Harrison murmured.
Maybe. But that wasn't the main reason he wanted her to film it. You see, we were right in thinking a person had to be wounded spiritually in order to be opened up deeply enough to be infected. But we were wrong in thinking that someone else had to hurt them. Because the deepest wounds aren't the ones we get from other people hurting us. They are the wounds we give ourselves when we hurt other people. Harrison drew in a long breath and leaned back to look at me.
Jesus, you mean they wanted Sylvia Yarrow to film Serenity burning herself to death?
Because to film such a thing, instead of trying to stop it, would be so terrible that it would slash your spirit open to the core. Harlan was right there, hanging around, watching like a hawk, and he tried to stop me interfering with her. I think he was waiting for it to happen, and when Sylvia stood there and filmed Serenity burning herself, he would have infected her. I think he would only have to touch her. When Harlan tried to infect me, he just grabbed hold of me and put his skin against mine. I could feel that some part of his senses were extended, and I think the sickness is responsible for that. It does to its victims what the accident did to me. I guess it just activates some potential humans have so they can reach inside a person and make contact with their spirit. Then they use that to infect more people. That's probably why someone infected can't immediately infect someone else. The sickness needs time to change them so they can do it. But they still have a choice. Look at Mum and Sari. It got to them and changed them, but they resisted full infection. We stood for a while in silence, and I thought how hard it must be to fight and to keep on fighting, knowing you could not be cured. I thought of the sick wrongness that had touched me when Harlan held me and shuddered. It had been unable to get into me because there had been no wound by which it could enter, and I had been able to drive it away by showing it the very part of my spirit that it wanted to destroy. I had lost my extended abilities, but I was still the same person inside, and I would go on fighting with the others. It didn't matter that there was no longer anything special about me. I had shown myself that a whole spirit was all it took to drive off the sickness. That was worth knowing.
"For goodness sake," Jilly said indignantly, and we sprang apart guiltily. She burst out laughing.
"Oh, very subtle. I hung around for at least 15 minutes waiting for the kiss, but since you still seem to be working up to it and I'm starving, I just wanted to tell you that Raoul and I are going to get the pizza that Harrison came to ask you about 30 minutes ago."
"Oh, the pizza," Harrison said, flushed and running his hands through his pale hair.
"I guess your mind isn't exactly on food right now," Jilly said kindly. She gave me a look of delighted mischief as she passed around the corner. I looked at Harrison, and all of a sudden we both started laughing. We laughed so much that we wound up leaning against the wall. Then Harrison said, "About that kiss."
"Oh," I said. He turned to face me, pressing me against the wall, and removing his glasses, holding my gaze all the while, refusing to let me look away or close my eyes as he moved closer. I felt the heat of his lips and the warm rush of his breath. And then he did what he had promised to do, kissing not only the breath, but all the laughter out of me.
"Oh," I said again, when he let me go.
"Very profound," Harrison said, grinning, and kissed me again.
And this time, I smelled wood smoke and lavender and chocolate.
Acknowledgements. My thanks to the real Alizon Whitestar and her family, strangers whose names I borrowed after an extraordinary dusk encounter, and to Nan McNabb for the edit of the original edition of this book. Thanks also to Robin Donoghue for her editing comments, and to Paul Collins for his meticulous edit of this current edition. It seems you can gild the lily. Also, thank you to Adelaide Stolber and Kathy Larson for finessing this cover into being, and to Marijke Lubscher for lending us her face. Why a re-edition of Alizon White Star? In part, it was because it was out of print and people kept asking me about it, both those who wanted to find it to reread, as well as those who had heard of it and wanted to track down a copy. But even more than that, I wanted to see it return to print because writing it allowed me to deeply ponder an aspect of the human condition that has always troubled me. The fact that, as a race, we are capable of compassion, courage, and beauty, yet paradoxically we are equally capable of producing horror. The answers I found seem even more relevant and important today than when I first wrote the book. Isabel Carmody, Brisbane, 2016.
Belinda hopes you enjoyed the reading of Alizon White Star, written and read by Isabel Carmody. Our audiobooks are hugely popular all around the world. If you really enjoyed this audiobook, make sure you introduce your friends to it, or even better, listen to audiobooks with your friends. If you want to hear more, there's more available online at belinda.com, or you can write to us. If you like, we can forward your letters on to our famous authors and narrators. We know they're always happy to hear from you. Thanks for listening, and remember to always take a Belinda audiobook with you.
Audible hopes you've enjoyed this program.